For all the women out there, can you think back to the first magazines you read with the advice about beauty blunders or quiz to find out how good of a kisser you'd be? Well, times, thankfully, have changed.
Teen Vogue is forming into be this kind of powerhouse incubator that takes young activists and puts them in front of other young people and says, you can do this too.
That's Harvard student Nadia Akimoto talking to ABC News. We talked to some engaged teens throughout Illinois and a former editor of Rookie magazine about the new wave of so-called girls media. Plus, Jeannie Ives talks about why she should be the next governor and how she'd tackle our budget problems.
Anybody who says, well, we're going to, you know, cut a few jobs here or set a price on paper is kidding themselves if they think they can balance their budget doing that way. Everything in the state of Illinois has to be a big reform agenda.
But first, Black Panther broke box office records this weekend. And according to Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips, it's also breaking the mold when it comes to gun violence in the movies. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, Illinois state health officials announced three more new cases of Legionnaires' disease at the Illinois Veterans Home in Quincy. This is the fourth outbreak in less than 4 years. The illness has been linked to the deaths of 13 people at the state-run facility since 2015. Today, members of Governor Rauner's administration are testifying in another hearing before lawmakers about their handling of the outbreaks. Senator Tammy Duckworth is also scheduled to visit the home. Dave McKinney has been reporting on this story for WBEZ in Chicago. They're the ones that originally have been reporting on this actually for some time now. He's on the line with us from Chicago. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, good morning, Nala.
Dave, what's the focus of today's testimony?
Well, this is all about a report that was commissioned in 2016 by a consultant that the state hired to basically look at what additional steps needed to be taken at the home. I mean, basically, this consultant studied the, you know, the most, I guess, the oldest stretches of plumbing at the home. It's galvanized pipe that's, you know, basically been, a lot of it is a century old. It's filled with gunk. That's where this Legionella is believed to be harbored.
The bacteria,
they
right?
They estimated that about the bacteria that causes Legionnaires' disease. And they estimated in 2016 that this would cost about $8 million to replace. This detail had not been known by the legislative committee that's studying this. And it differs a great deal from numbers that were put out there not only by the Director of Veteran Affairs during an earlier hearing on this, but also in our reporting here at WBEZ. We were told that making the necessary repairs to you know, forever insulate Quincy from the home in Quincy from Legionnaires' disease would cost $500 million. So, I mean, these numbers are all over the board.
I mean, that's a big difference, yeah.
Huge difference. And I think that's what this hearing today is about, to try to sort all of that out.
WBEZ has been doing extensive reporting on that. We will tweet out links to the reporting that Dave just referenced. But, Dave, some of the criticism regarding previous outbreaks, and you've reported on this in the past, was that the Illinois Department of Public Health and the governor were not transparent enough when it comes to disclosing outbreaks. What about these three more cases that were just announced? Is there any sense that that's changing?
In terms of transparency, I would say generally they have, you know, at least in notifying people that there are more people getting sick, they do get credit for that. But, I mean, the legislative committees that are looking into this, as well as us and other media outlets that are pursuing this, we've all been denied email requests for emails. This has been a long-running open records pursuit with them, and they keep wanting to have us narrow, and you know, they've not been willing to divulge emails from any of these outbreaks. And AP was successful, at least in getting a tiny little sliver of that, which contained this report. Something else to consider, I mean, this report was done in late 2016, and what we know is from the beginning of 2017 through now, nine more people got sick with Legionnaires after this report was out there, and one of those people died. So, I mean, there were consequences in not acting.
Can you tell us how the patients are doing right now, who the most recent patients? Do we know?
Well, I mean, the only thing that we know is what the state tells us, and these folks all are said to be recovering. The one that I guess is sort of a bit of, you know, the one that has created a bit of embarrassment for Governor Rauner, there was a guest of his who was an audience member at his State of the State address He was one who wound up contracting Legionnaires' disease. He was is a 79-year-old Air Force veteran. He was somebody that Rauner met during his visit at the Quincy home, where he spent about a week in January.
When the governor stayed at the home.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And to correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, Legionella is a disease that if it's caught early is something that's treatable. This doesn't have to be a fatal illness.
No, and bear in mind that you know, the folks that are at the veterans home, are many of them are frail. So they're, you know, they have compromised immune systems and they're really susceptible to this. And, you know, it's typically transmitted through breathing in steam from, you know, whirlpools or showers or, you know, just any kind of vapor like that from the air conditioning system. And so, yes, antibiotics can treat this if it's known quickly enough. The complaint we have heard over and over and over again from some of the families of the 13 who died was that nobody told them that this was that this was even over there, when it appears that at least the agencies knew for a period of time that they had an outbreak on their hands in 2015.
And Dave, you mentioned some of the families. There has been a lawsuit filed by some of those families who lost relatives to Legionnaires in the initial outbreak. What's the latest with that?
Well, there are 11 lawsuits filed with the State Court of Claims. All of these families, you know, are basically alleging the same thing, that there was negligence committed on the part of the State Department of Veteran Affairs, which runs the Quincy home. They say that the home and the agency knew that Legionnaires was a problem there dating back to July of 2015. Most of these residents were getting sick and dying during August and September of that year. And this is a very lengthy process. I mean, the trial, if there is a trial, could be sometime in 2019, from what our reporting has shown so far. So, I mean, it's still a ways off. And remember that state law caps what these families can receive in damages because of this at $100,000, which, you know, other Legionnaires cases that we've researched that have happened at, like, there was a big outbreak in Chicago at the JW Marriott. Those cases sometimes yielded payouts of $2 million for a lot of families. And all these families that we've talked to say they don't want the money. That's not the biggest issue here. They just want this place fixed. It's really an important place in Quincy. There's great pride in the community about it. They just want people to quit getting sick and dying there.
One last question for you, Dave. The CDC was back there last week as well. Governor Rauner actually even mentioned the Quincy home in his budget address, offering the possibility of shutting it down. What's going on with all of that, and what did the CDC say about that?
Well, we're still waiting to hear what the CDC has to say about this latest outbreak. You know, the governor in his budget address, you know, did offer up $50 million to make repairs and renovations at the Quincy home. It's not clear really what he intends to spend that money on there. I mean, you know, the most recent report that we have gotten from this consultant that was cited in the AP report from 2016, that those numbers have been updated and show that up to, I think, $24 million is what they're projecting now in repairs there. But what happens with the remaining balance of that, Rauner hasn't said yet.
WBEZ Chicago's Dave McKinney. WBEZ has been doing extensive reporting, as I mentioned, on this outbreak of Legionella at the Illinois Veterans Home in Quincy. We'll tweet that out. Dave, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Nala, thanks for having me.
Lots of anticipation for the movie Black Panther. In fact, we talked about it last Friday on the 21st. And after the three-day weekend, box office reports have Marvel's first film, directed by an African-American, bringing in almost $230 million in North America, breaking a lot of records in the process. Whether or not you rushed out to see it, as I did, you can sense that this movie is impacting the industry in big ways when it comes to race and gender. But what about violence? Certainly after last week in particular, when the country is mourning the lives of those killed by a gunman in Parkland, Florida, it's hard not to think about that when we're looking at action on the screen. And it's something that Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips has been thinking about for a long time. His recent headline read, "I'm fed up with guns in the movies again." And he's on the line with us from Chicago. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Michael, we're coming off this week, as I mentioned, of horrific gun violence, not just in Florida. Chicago police officer Paul Bauer was shot and killed. And I wanted to ask, sort of in the context of that, when did you have a chance to screen The Black Panther?
Well, we saw it here in Chicago a fair bit later than anybody in Los Angeles and New York did, like several weeks later. So that was sort of a shame for our purposes, because the word was good on this movie, and actually the word turned out to be accurate. But we saw it Tuesday afternoon, and then, you know, by late Tuesday afternoon, word came down that the police commander, Paul Bauer, who was another parent at two of our kids' schools, had been shot and killed. So, yeah, I mean, both locally, as you mentioned, locally with Paul Bauer's death and, of course, nationally with the Florida shooting with 17 dead, it's been a hell of a week. And then, you know, as a critic and as a civilian, you watch a movie, whatever movie you're looking at, in this context. You cannot forget it entirely as you watch whatever you're watching.
And that, I mean, that's the hard thing about this, Michael. And I was just thinking about when I saw the movie White House Down, it was right after the Boston Marathon bombing. And honestly, it made me kind of sick. Like, I couldn't watch it just sort of in the context of real life events. And I feel like this is kind of what you wrote about this, right? We'll tweet out the piece that you wrote, but you wrote, there's another mass murder in our country. Whenever there's another mass murder, action films become sort of the strange and ghoulish experience beyond whatever filmmakers have created for our consumption. And I know that filmmakers can't anticipate the context in which we'll see their movies, but what are your thoughts on this? What could and should they be doing better?
Yeah, I mean, really specifically with the Black Panther film, it's just called Black Panther. I'm sorry. I guess one of the heartening personality traits of this movie, which is really good, is that while there's an awful lot of the usual gun violence in it, and it's rated PG-13, and it's got a fair amount of violence of all kinds in it, and you can call it comic book violence or not, that's up to you. But because the story Black Panther is telling, it takes place in this fictional, fantastic, you know, African nation of Wakanda, where, you know, it's the most advanced civilization on Earth. The weaponry is like insanely high tech, and the film itself is not as indebted to and in love with conventional weaponry and hardware. And, you know, this is not an Iron Man picture, is what I'm saying. And in fact, the film is, according to KidsInMind.com, which measures in a quantified kind of objective way, you know, what's the violence quotient in this film, what's the sex, what's the language, you know, for all kinds of films. It's KidsInMind.com. Anyway, Black Panther is, in fact, less violent than Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 3 and Captain America's Civil War and the Avengers. And, that's according to one source. But I, as a civilian watching Black Panther, I was actually kind of pleased that there's a great throwaway line in the middle of that. Do you remember the chase sequence in Busan?
Yeah, and actually we have it. So would you like to hear it? Yeah, let's hear it.
Guns. So primitive.
So if everyone heard that, Michael, you want to repeat what she said there?
Well, this is Letitia Wright, who's just a fantastic ringer in this great cast of as Shuri, King T'Challa's sister, and she's kind of the one woman geek squad and inventor, and she's basically like Q in the James Bond pictures, but it's Wakanda, right? And here they are, taking on Claw and his henchmen, and of course the semi-automatic weapons come out, and she just says, "Guns, so primitive," you know. And it's a throwaway line, but this week in particular, we're talking about last week when it opened, that line landed differently than it would have the week before. This film, you know, maybe I don't want to extrapolate too much from one throwaway line, which is a good one, but this film is a little less indebted to and in love with the usual drooling close-ups of whatever weapons of mass destruction Tony Stark and the gang are putting forth for our amusement. You know, it's there's a fair bit of it, but it's a different, it's got a different vibe altogether. It's one of the many distinctive and I think refreshing things about Ryan Coogler's film.
And how much of this, too, is, I wonder how much of, and I think, and we can get into this after the break, if you can stick around with us, Michael, that would be great. But how much of this is about action films? And I've heard this from other people before, that the reason there's not that much dialogue and there's so much reliance on a lot of shooting or other things is in a part because of international audiences and not having and not needing to necessarily speak English in order to enjoy the film. Do you feel like that is a part of this that factors into action movies?
Yeah, I would say nonverbal brutality is the international language of movies. You know, and if that sounds cynical, I think, you know, all you have to do is look at the results. I mean, the Transformers movie, I don't think anyone goes to a Transformers movie for the dialogue. Why do you go to a Transformers movie? You want to watch a microwave beat up a toaster for 3 hours, and that works in any language, or, you know, from my perspective, it doesn't work in any language, but it's popular and successful. That is the currency of action filmmaking. Black Panther, I think it's going to be very interesting to see if it really is as huge a success internationally as it's going to be and already is in North America, because, you know, one of the great strengths of the storytelling here is that it's a culturally specific Marvel comic origin story. It's a great kind of African myth that has one foot in the real world, and of course one foot, maybe two or three additional feet in this Marvel, you know, comic book world. But it all feels like it's actually coming from a filmmaker who had a couple ideas about what he wanted to say about how this story should work in 2018 America. That's why it works.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Michael Phillips on the 21st.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, publisher of scholarly and regional interest books and journals, allowing local and global readers to understand and engage with the changing world. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All right, that's not Black Panther. That's Iron Man. Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips is with me as we're talking about violence in the movies, how Black Panther does that a little bit differently. I have to say, Michael, I'm not a huge fan of Iron Man. This is one of the many reasons why I'm not a huge fan of Iron Man. But I just get back to that contrast, right, of how Black Panther is doing it, right, in your opinion, less focus on guns. You kind of felt the human impact of the violence, right? Even the way in which it was done, there weren't weapons. And I wonder for you, that, I mean, how much that really goes against the grain of what we often see in movies.
Well, the people are kind of aware of it consciously or not watching Black Panther. I think it's the fact that it's a lot of, well, Ryan Coogler is the director. He's only made 3 feature films, Fruitvale Station, the improbably good Rocky sequel Creed, starring Michael B. Jordan, and now Black Panther, which features Michael B. Jordan as this formidable adversary, Killmonger of King T'Challa, Black Panther, right, played by Chadwick Boseman. So it all comes down to these very kind of epic one-on-one gladiatorial style combat sequences, and a lot of them are really kind of painful, I would say, almost in the right way as opposed to the wrong way. A lot of action movies never, especially if you look at the DC Comics movies like Superman versus Batman, a movie, you know, that's 2.5 hours I'll never get back in my life. You know, those action scenes just ground, you know, the audience
down. I fell
down.
Asleep watching that movie on a plane.
I was wishing devoutly for sleep, but it didn't happen. But it that's a director, Zack Snyder, who doesn't really care or know about how to make these stories matter in human terms, you know, like you were rooting interest. I think Black Panther is very different, and the fact that you have in the final sequence, without any spoilers, you have a major character bidding farewell, let's say, to the story in a way that really kind of presents him as a complicated and kind of a morally ambiguous human being. It actually makes the audience feel and think a little bit. Now, how often do you say that in Iron Man? You know, I mean, the whole arc of Iron Man is this high-tech zillionaire played by Robert Downey Jr. You know, is a weapons manufacturer. It's really just more about his narcissism and his kind of, you know, becoming a Hollywood superstar and forgetting who, you know, for losing his soul in the process and then regaining it and trying to be a team player and all that. You know, this is really, I hate to say it as a middle-aged white man, but this is a middle-aged white man's problem, you know, that sort of stuff. And Black Panther is just finally, you get women who are not marginalized in the story. You get great actresses really going to town with these roles. You get all these performers of color who just, you know, have been sidelined in so many stories like this all the way through. And here, there's no apology. You know, this is a movie that does not care about the rest of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, and let's see, Michael, it remains to be seen if this will have an impact on other action movies. I guess we'll wait and see. Michael Phillips is a Chicago Tribune film critic. His piece about this, we will tweet out if you'd like to read more. Michael, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla. It was good.
As I mentioned, we've all been thinking and talking about the tragic massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where 17 students were killed in a mass shooting last week. But after it, it was the words of a teenager that went viral.
We need to pay attention to the fact that this isn't just a mental health issue. He wouldn't have harmed that many students with a knife! How about we stop blaming the victims for something that was the shooter's fault?
That's Emma Gonzalez via CNN. She was speaking at an anti-gun rally in Fort Lauderdale on Saturday. Emma joins fellow classmates, 15-year-old Christine Yared. She wrote an op-ed about gun control for the New York Times. She was on Morning Edition earlier today, if you heard her. Delaney Tarr also wrote an op-ed for Teen Vogue released yesterday. All outspoken, all passionate, all teenage girls. It makes sense, then, that the world of teen magazines should be changing. Teen Vogue, in particular, is leading the fray. In 2016, the magazine gained national attention when it published an article titled Donald Trump is Gaslighting America. Since then, there's been a lot of discussion about the increasingly political nature of teen publications. So we wanted to talk about that this morning on the program. And I'm joined in studio now by Salma Elnagar. She's a sophomore at University High School in Urbana. Also joining me on the line is Lena Singer. Lena's a former managing editor for Rookie Magazine. It's an online magazine for teen girls. It was created by fashion blogger and Oak Park native Tavi Gevinson. Lena's now a Chicago-based writer for Outlets and Crane Chicago Magazine. Salma, Lena, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Salma, can I start by asking you just about the events last week in Florida? I imagine you're at Uni High in Urbana, this is something lots of your classmates are probably talking about right now, right?
Yeah, but personally, I didn't think, it wasn't really talked about at school. And this was like one issue that really hit home for me personally, like as soon as I heard about it. And on Twitter, the people, like the victims, they posted everything online. So it was like, I think this was the one shooting that like actually, like I felt like I felt it. It really hurt. I cried. It was really heartbroken, especially there's one video a girl posted. It was pretty graphic. I didn't expect it to be graphic, but everyone was bawling and there was bodies all over the floor. And it's a video, like you see the bodies, you see blood smeared in the classroom. Like that's just so scary and so heartbreaking, especially since, at least for me at my school, we don't really practice like what will happen if an active shooter comes. So having that to like become a reality and that it's so common nowadays, it's really, really scary.
Yeah, I can't imagine how hard that must be. I mean, it's scary for all of us, and we're not in a school on a daily basis like you are. I wonder, as you've watched all of the young women your age, Emma and all of these other young women in Florida, they're actually marching to the State House in Tallahassee today. Have you seen all of that also, their sort of activism?
Yeah, I'm a very big political activist, especially since ever since Donald Trump's election and everything, especially in eighth grade. I'm really into that. I don't know.
So you're in 10th grade now.
Yeah, I'm in 10th grade. But ever since eighth grade, especially when the primaries and everything, the election started happening, I was really into all of that. And at school, we used to watch the news a lot and we had these discussions. And I'm the person that's kind of passionate about it. People know if like they need news or if they need to know what's going on, they tend to come to me. So I'm really interested in that. And it's like,
so do you read Teen Vogue? Do you read it? Do you read it online?
I read it online.
Right. Do you read like online or on Twitter?
I don't know if they're on Snapchat. Yeah, I follow them on Twitter.
Yeah.
The one article where it was the Donald Trump article. It was really inspiring because we tend to think as teens like we can't make an impact. We can't really do anything. Nothing that we do can change anything. But Teen Vogue, like these girls are talking about cultural appropriation, gun violence, Donald Trump, sexual harassment and assault, and the fact that we're all speaking up and that, yeah, it happens to teens. It's not necessarily only adults. I mean, the Time's Up movement is particularly adult women, but that we also experience this is really inspiring.
I'm speaking with University High sophomore Salma El Nogar. She's at in Urbana. On the line with us from Chicago is Lena Singer. She's a former editor of Rookie Magazine. Lena, what do you think about as you're listening to Salma and we're talking about other young women like Emma Gonzalez and Delaney Tarr? How much do you think this is Teen Vogue is sort of just capturing and maybe channeling an energy that's happening among teenagers today?
You know, I think Teen Vogue was listening to their teen readers, and instead of dictating to them what they were needing to hear, they were taking in what these teenagers were saying were important to them. And the way they were able to do that was, like Salma mentioned, through social media. So instead of saying, teens, listen to us, we're the authority, amplifying those teen voices and giving them a platform, they were very smart to do that when they did.
Yeah. And Lena, I wonder if you can just tell us a little bit about, I mean, my era of teen magazines was sort of like quizzes and like, you know, maybe there was a little girl power kind of in there. I mean, maybe you can get for a sense for people who aren't reading Teen Vogue or people who aren't familiar with Rookie, the magazine that you worked on. Maybe you can explain, like with Rookie, how different was that when it came out originally from other magazines at the time?
Well, the special thing about Rookie was that it was started by a teenager, Tavi Gevinson, when she was 15. And we had teen contributors, and still to this day, the magazine focuses mostly on teen contributors. So adults were really only there in a role to support them and their voices. And they drove the topics that we were talking about. Everything was written in their voice. All of our art was coming from their perspective. So it was really meant to be for them and by them.
And as we say that, Salma, you mentioned there are a couple articles that you were really, or that you're particularly interested in on social justice and cultural appropriation. Let's start with those. Why those issues specifically? Do you feel like you read about this in other publications?
Kind of, but it's not from a teenager's point of view. It tends to be like an adult point of view, and Teen Vogue really does a good job of like letting teenagers speak out, because adults tend to think like they know us or they understand us, and that's not necessarily the case. But especially the cultural appropriation article came out during Christopher Columbus Day, and like it was talking about like Halloween and what costumes, because I don't know, some teens, like, they don't really care about these issues when we really should, because we are the future. This is like, we're supposed to like create the world that we want to live in starting now. And so seeing these people explain like what cultural appropriation hurts, like how it affects them, and like me personally, I faced like some racism and stuff, so seeing other people like talk about it is like, I don't know, relatable in a sense.
Yeah, well, it makes you feel like you're not alone.
Yeah.
And you realize there are other young women out there who are as engaged as you are. Do you feel like that's where you do you feel like you get a lot of inspiration from that?
Yeah. First, yeah, especially Emma Gonzalez, her speech. I saw it, the whole like 8-minute video.
Mm-hmm.
Like she spoke better than anyone I've ever heard, like any adult, all these especially like these senators and everything, making it like it's not gun violence. Guns isn't going to change anything. Gun reform laws aren't going to change anything. And she spoke the truth. She said, yeah, it is. I mean, it is a gun violence issue. We don't have any reforms. If he was so, quote unquote, mentally ill, he shouldn't have had a gun. He shouldn't have any access to any weapons, but he did, because there's no background checks. We don't have any reforms. So for seeing that it's teenagers that are taking charge and they're the ones that are marching shows you how much like we can change. We can make an impact.
And so for you, a teenager here in Illinois, this is happening in Florida. What are you doing now? What are you thinking you're going to be doing?
So there's going to be a national school walkout on the anniversary of the Columbine shooting. And I'm planning to organize it at our school. I still need to talk to the administration and everything, but I think we're going to do it at our school. And especially since the other high schools in town are planning to do it as well, I think it's really important for us at least to show support to the tragedy that happened in Parkland.
So that's really in helping inform your activism, it sounds like, as well.
Yeah.
Lena, one last question for you. Do you think this is something new, or is this just something we're just now starting to notice and it's been around for a while? Young people, I mean, the movement. Yeah.
I think that the exciting thing is it's probably not as new as adults think. And where it is something that probably adults aren't quite grasping yet. Because teenagers have the means to produce their own media and to be in touch with each other, like Salma was talking about, you know, I wouldn't say that it happened at any one point in time, because I'm probably not aware of when it happened. Teenagers are. So I think that more and more we will see publications like Rookie by and for teenagers. There are other really important ones, like ones that Teen Vogue was inspired by, including Art Ho Collective, which is a teen-made media project in Florida. And then, you know, activist groups that are being led by teenagers, including the Never Again Project that is coming out of Florida now from those students in Marjorie mm-hmm. Stoneman Douglas.
Yeah.
And then groups like United We Dream that are
right.
organizing
so, yeah,
through social
there's
media.
Just all of these different movements. Selma, I want to let you have the last word. Do you have all these adults who are listening? What do you want them to know about your thoughts and what you're doing?
That don't try to belittle us. We have a voice. We are at this age where it is our time. It's time for us to create the world that we want to live in the future. We understand things now. We know what's going on. We demand change. We need change. We do not deserve to go to school and be afraid whether or not we're going to come back home, or we might not see our parents again. And it's seeing some adults saying like it's not a gun violence issue, or we don't know what we're doing, just proves the fact that we do need change. We are gonna be that change. We are making that change.
That's University High in Urbana sophomore Salma Eldnogar. I want to thank you, Salma, for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Lena Singer as well, a former editor from Rookie Magazine. Both of you, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Before we go, I just wanted to make a note about yesterday's program. We've been airing interviews with candidates for governor. Yesterday, we started with J.B. Pritzker. During the interview, I asked him about a debate that had been planned for March 5th in Springfield, organized by WCIA. He said during the interview they weren't joining the debate because organizers reached out late. And I just wanted to note, yesterday evening, his campaign reached out to us to say that he misspoke about that timing, but they would not comment as to why he will not attend the debate. Yesterday, WCIA said they were canceling that. Coming up next, we're going to be hearing from Governor Rauner's Republican primary opponent, State Representative Jeannie Ives. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're continuing our series of interviews with the candidates running for governor. The primary is on March 20th. We've recorded conversations with 7 of the 8 candidates in the running, and we're going to be airing these at the same time on the show every day until next Tuesday. Just a reminder, there's 6 Democrats that are hoping to win in the primary. There are 2 Republicans running. One, of course, is incumbent Governor Rauner. We've reached out to his office several times repeatedly over the past couple of weeks. They have not responded to our requests for an interview. Today, we're hearing from his challenger, Jeannie Ives. She's a state representative from Illinois' 42nd House District, which includes Wheaton, where she's lived for the past 26 years. She's been in office for 3 terms. Prior to that, she served on Wheaton City Council. She's a graduate of West Point, who also served in the Army. Representative Ives, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you for having me on.
We know that Illinois went more than 2 years without having a full budget, and many think that the most vulnerable people in our state have been hit hard and in many ways are still recovering from that. Why should voters entrust you with helping to make sure that doesn't happen ever again?
Well, I promise to, first of all, submit a balanced budget that makes sure that we spend within our means, and that is something that Governor Rauner failed to do. And it is, and also listeners should be very wary, because all the Democrats are asking for is more taxes to spend more money. We will not be doing that in my administration.
I did want to ask you about taxes. That's obviously been a prominent issue in the past few years. Last year, we saw the individual income tax rate go from 3.75% to 4.95%. The corporate tax rate went up to 7%. Let's start with the personal income tax rate. You've said you would rescind this. How would you do that with a democratically controlled legislature?
Well, I actually never said that I would rescind it immediately, because I know that I need legislative buy-in. So I'm the one candidate who is not being dishonest about that. And so what I plan to do is budget down to the level where we can prove up to folks that we can live within our means at a lower level. And the only way we're going to do that, though, is get the reforms in that we need so we can expand the tax base.
And when you say lower level, what are you thinking about?
I'd like to take it back to the 3% level. And I'd like to eventually, over time, eliminate the corporate income tax.
And what about property taxes?
Property taxes are a huge issue. It's a bigger problem than our state income taxes, quite frankly, because right now it's confiscatory. The South Suburban Cook area has been decimated by high tax rates, and people are losing their homes. Government cannot afford to continue along the same path because their residents are leaving. So property taxes don't need to be frozen at the highest levels. They need to be lowered substantially over time. We'd like to cap them, as Indiana does, but we have to have the reforms in order to do it. And if we don't do it, you're going to continue to see people flee the state of Illinois over their property taxes. That's why over 100,000 people left the state of Illinois last year, and with them walked nearly $5 billion in income. We have to control property taxes. You are stealing people's property from them. They are literally renting their homes from their superintendents.
And what do you think about retirement income?
Taxing retirement income?
Correct, yeah. Should retirement income
I'm not in favor No, I'm not in favor of any new taxes in the state of Illinois at this time until we control our budget and control our spending. If you want to talk about realigning our tax system, I'm very much open to that. I would prefer to have taxes on consumption rather than income. But if we were to do that right now without any other changes and just decide to enact a tax on retirement income with, I'm talking no other changes, all that's going to happen is our retirees will leave the state of Illinois. And we can't afford anybody to leave the state of Illinois. That said, we have a number of public pensioners that are retiring still in their mid to late 50s, making six-figure pensions and not paying a dime in income tax on that. There's a mechanism where we need to correct that as well. I would agree, but it's got to be looked at holistically, and it can't be just done as a standalone one thing.
So let's talk about that holistically for a moment. As you're talking about the plan, as you well know, Illinois has incredible balances and pension obligations. Where would you cut in the budget to, first of all, create a balanced budget and still be able to fulfill all of the current fiscal and future financial obligations?
We would look for reform, large and small. Anybody who says, well, we're going to, cut a few jobs here or get a better price on paper is kidding themselves if they think they can balance their budget doing that way. Everything in the state of Illinois has to be a big reform agenda. Look, the state is bankrupt. It owes over $250 billion in pension and debt obligations. It's the worst-run state in the union. It's got the worst credit rating by a long shot. When it goes out to borrow, it has borrowing costs that are three times worse than the next worst state. We're an outlier in so many ways. None of this is going to be done with a massive tax increase or with cutting small parts of government. You have to literally reform how we do business in every aspect. And so what I want to do is tackle pension reform first and foremost. And the easiest thing to get across that would signal to the bond community, would signal to the business community, would signal to residents who are being punished by paying for everybody else's pension but their own. The biggest thing you can do is tell people we're not going to dig the hole deeper, and you do that by putting all new hires into a 401k-style program. That would send a strong signal that we're finally going to arrest our problems.
Representative Ives, as you mention all of these things, we've also been asking our listeners to chime in via social media with questions they want to ask, and we got a question from Reddit that I imagine is on the mind of many people in our state. And I'm thinking about it as you're talking about all of these things that you'd like to accomplish. How do you plan to work, whether that's across the aisle with Democrats or within your own party, to make sure that things actually get done?
I've already done that. So I'm one of the few of the candidates that has actually been down in Springfield and worked with folks that are going to have to help pass the legislation that we need to fix Illinois. So I've already been successful in working with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to pass reform measures. I know where they stand on issues, and I know what their districts want from them in return. So I can build the coalitions because I understand them much better than our sitting governor, quite frankly, and most of the Democrat candidates. So I have an understanding of how to build the coalitions to get the reform across. Is super important, as well as the fact of what my colleagues would say about me is that you know where I stand. So you know that I can be trusted when I say I'm going to do what I want to do and will give my word on particular legislation, unlike our current governor, Bruce Rauner, who basically lied to members of our caucus, lied to Cardinal Supich, and then said he's not in charge. Dramatically different approaches to how we would get legislation through.
You mentioned Cardinal Supich. I wanted to ask you about one of the most controversial issues that Governor Rauner faced last year, and that's HB 40. Just a reminder for our audience, it's the bill that would cover abortions for Medicaid recipients and state workers. It would also keep abortions legal in Illinois should Roe versus Wade be overturned. Was that for you the turning point in why you decided to run?
That was the turning point for everybody else who called me after he signed it and said somebody needs to run against him and we'd like you to do it. I had a number of phone calls from people around the state asking me to challenge Governor Rauner. And for me, it was definitely one of the tipping points. But look, I lost confidence in that guy about a year prior to that when he signed on to a huge, massive bailout of a multi-billion-dollar profitable public utility company. And then I lost confidence when he bailed out Chicago Public Schools with taxpayer money statewide. And then I lost confidence when he enacted, you know, legislation requiring pro-life pregnancy centers to refer for abortion. But yes, the, you know, taxpayer funding of abortion is a majority position of folks polled, including Democrats, say taxpayers should not pay for it. So Governor Rauner is the person who's on the fringe, who doesn't respect taxpayer money. You know, nobody should start a brand new open-ended entitlement program in a state that is bankrupt. And that's what he did. And then he lied about it on top of it. So it has been one betrayal after another by that Governor Rauner, and nobody trusts him. It's universal. In my caucus, in the Democrat caucus, in the media, nobody trusts his word.
Representative Ives, another issue you've been very vocal on is in immigration. Do you think state resources should be used to help enforce federal immigration law when it comes to detention and deportation?
I think we should have a spirit of cooperation between federal, local, and state law enforcement. And Governor Rauner signed his signature on SB 31, which made us a sanctuary state, totally abolished that notion. He made us all less safe. We can now not get justice when criminal illegal aliens commit crimes in the state of Illinois. They can post off of a detainer, leave the system, and escape across Mexico to Mexico, which is exactly what happened in the case of Dennis McCann, whose brother Brian is still awaiting justice for his brother who was killed by a criminal illegal immigrant.
So, Representative Ives, can I
have a lot to answer to?
Yeah, well, but the Trust Act was something that law enforcement, that people worked with law enforcement on. So do you think that law enforcement also made a mistake in signing on to the Trust Act? Because that was something that they helped write in Illinois.
Here's what's interesting. I actually understand how the game is played down in Springfield, and most of your listeners probably don't. But what happens is that some of these associations get bullied into taking a position or not, or a bill gets worked down from many pages down to a few pages, and then people say, well, the bill's been worked, it must be great, it must be fine now. Nothing could be further than the truth. When I talk to individual law enforcement officers, when I talk to colleagues of mine who are actual law enforcement officers serving as state representatives, when I talk to them, they tell you they believe it's a sanctuary state bill and that it makes us less safe and it makes it less safe for them to do their job. That's what they say about that bill. So, sure, there's probably some associations that negotiated the bill, but they negotiated down from a terrible bill, an atrocious bill, down to a bill that still made us a sanctuary state. And they took what they thought they could get.
We just have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you very quickly about education. The overhaul, the historic school funding reform that happened last year. Illinois has the most inequitable funding system in the country for funding K-12 school funding. Why did you vote against the overhaul? And I wonder, did you also support Governor Rauner's amendatory veto that was recently also overridden?
I did not vote to override it, but I did not support the first bill at all. Absolutely not. There's nothing that in there that's going to make education funding more equitable. That is a farce. First of all, we don't have the $3.5 billion over 10 years that it's going to take that the bill requires to fund. And the minute we don't spend $350 million a year, it's the minute that Chicago gets a preponderance of the education dollars. That did nothing to ensure equity of funding, and it did nothing about accountability. In fact, it locked in the most inequitable system of funding public education because it held everybody harmless, and every school district gets now the same amount of money they got last year, regardless of student population moving, regardless of property values fluctuating. The unfair system they had before is now locked in, and it doesn't account for anybody who's doing more with less and giving them and plussing them up, which it should be that the case. It should be done on a merit base.
Right. We just have a minute left, so I just want to ask you very quickly
Okay. Why
you want to be governor.
Because I know what's going on down there. I understand that the desperation of Illinois taxpayers gained in a system that they can't control. and I'm the only one with the right ideas to move the state forward. I'm the only one who's going to be honest with the taxpayers about finally solving our problems.
Really quickly, Representative Ives, do you have a favorite place to visit in Illinois?
I love visiting Cantini. It's the homestead of Colonel Robert McCormick. It's where the 1st Division Museum is. It's where his home is there, and it's turned into a public space that's absolutely beautiful, and it's a tribute to the military.
Jeannie Ives is a state representative. She represents Illinois' 42nd House District, which includes Wheaton, where she lives. She's been in office for 3 terms. She also served on Wheaton City Council, a graduate of West Point. She also served in the Army and is challenging Governor Bruce Rauner for the Republican nomination. Representative Ives, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes, Android, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a smartphone or smart speaker, if you have Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there. Just say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. You do have to have NPR One enabled. Directions for that, as well as every other way to contact us. If you want to follow us on social media, leave us a voicemail, send us an email. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Grace Stetson and Fatima Fahar are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.